From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, President Obama makes it clear U.S. forces will not be heading back to Iraq. The problem there is for Iraqi politicians to solve.
In the absence of this type of political effort, short-term military action won't succeed.
We'll discuss the crisis with the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad. Also today, the week-long gender violence conference wraps up in London. We've got a full report. The World Cup continues in Brazil as world soccer's governing body is engulfed by corruption allegations.
If there's change, I don't think it will come from inside FIFA, but it might come from external pressure.
And the global race to reinvent the state. Will the West win it? That's all ahead on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main news.
From feature story news in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama has confirmed he will not be sending troops to Iraq. His words came as militants with the Islamic State of Iraq in the Levant are less than 50 miles from Baghdad. He told reporters that he is reviewing options for action, but intensive diplomatic and political efforts are needed, especially by Iraqi leaders.
Any action that we may take to provide assistance to Iraqi security forces has to be joined by a serious and sincere effort by Iraq's leaders to set aside sectarian differences, to promote stability, and account for the legitimate interests of all of Iraq's communities, and to continue to build the capacity of an effective security force. We can't do it for them.
The American president's announcement came after Iraq's top Shia cleric, the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, issued a call to arms, urging the public to pick up weapons and fight back against the militants. Ukraine says it is now ready to compromise on a price for Russian natural gas in order to avert a cutoff of supply before a Monday deadline. Tension between Ukraine and Russia over gas debts and energy prices has escalated since fighting in East Ukraine saw pro-Russian separatists fight for independence, and the EU has been brokering last-minute talks which might resume on Saturday. Sandra Gatman has more from Brussels.
Chief executive of Ukraine's gas company Naftogaz, Andriy Kobolev, has said the EU's proposal to meet in the middle on future pricing for Russian natural gas is, in his words, not bad. An offer of $326 per 1,000 cubic meters has been proposed by the EU's energy commissioner, Günther Oettinger, who's been brokering talks between Ukraine and Russia since relations broke down after the ousting of Ukraine's president, Viktor Yanukovych. Russia has since doubled the price of its gas to Ukraine, but says the country owes Moscow $4 billion U.S. dollars in unpaid debts and demands Ukraine pay almost $2 billion by Monday or see a cut in energy supply that could affect the flow of natural gas to the rest of Europe.
U.S. Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl is back in the United States, being treated at an Army medical base in the state of Texas. Bergdahl was recently released by the Taliban after 5 years in captivity. The Obama administration's prisoner swap, which included the release of five Taliban prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay, has been sharply criticized. Lindsay Mastis reports from San Antonio, Texas.
Bo Bergdahl arrived at Brook Army Medical Center in San Antonio from Germany in middle of the night. He will eventually reunite with his parents, but instead of a welcome homecoming, his family has received death threats, and some soldiers who served with him claim Bergdahl had deserted his post before being captured by the Taliban. The U.S. Defense Department says Bergdahl is undergoing a three-step reintegration process. Once that's complete, the military will investigate the circumstances of his disappearance.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The U.S. government is auctioning off 30,000 seized bitcoins valued at over 17 million U.S. dollars. Bitcoins, the digital currency, was seized last year during a criminal investigation of the Silk Road online marketplace. Daniel Wrenches has the details.
The FBI cracked down on Silk Road, alleging that the exchange was being used by people selling illegal drugs and other illicit goods. Later this month, the U.S. Marshals Service will start auctioning off some 30,000 bitcoins worth $17 million. The U.S. government says it seized an additional 144,000 bitcoins and is preparing to bring to trial the owner and administrator of the site, Ross Ulbricht, who operated under the pseudonym Dead Pirate Roberts. The auction of such large numbers of bitcoins has the potential to depress the market price, which currently stands at about $600. Daniel Wrenches, Washington.
And it's a bit of good news for Australia's World Heritage site, the Great Barrier Reef. Australia's Federal Environment Minister Greg Hunt has said that the overall health of the Great Barrier Reef off the Queensland coast is still poor, but signs show it's on the mend. Arthur Stevens reports from Melbourne.
The latest report on the health of the Great Barrier Reef concludes it remains in poor condition despite improvements. But the Queensland State Government says it's confident it's done enough to satisfy UNESCO. The state and federal governments have signed an agreement on the management of the reef, and the Environment Minister says he's confident the world's largest coral reef system won't join UNESCO's in danger list because there have been improvements in water quality. I'm Arthur Stevens, Melbourne.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
Over the last several days, we've seen significant gains made by ISIL, a terrorist organization that operates in both Iraq and in Syria. In the face of a terrorist offensive, Iraqi security forces have proven unable to defend a number of cities.
President Obama speaking at the White House today on the worsening crisis in Iraq and telling reporters that he has no intention of seeing U.S. troops drawn back into the country's conflict.
We will not be sending U.S. troops back into combat in Iraq, but I have asked my national security team to prepare a range of other options that could help support Iraq security forces, and I'll be reviewing those options in the days ahead. I do want to be clear, though. This is not solely or even primarily a military challenge. Any action that we may take to provide assistance to Iraqi security forces has to be joined by a serious and sincere effort by Iraq's leaders to set aside sectarian differences, to promote stability, and account for the legitimate interests of all of Iraq's communities.
As the president's national security team was huddling at the White House, came news from Baghdad that the country's senior Shiite cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, was issuing a call to arms, urging able-bodied Shia supporters to pick up weapons and fight the Sunni militants who have seized territory and military hardware this week. He called it the legal and national responsibility of whoever can hold a weapon to hold it to defend the country. Earlier today, FSN's Lorna Shaddock spoke to the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, and started by asking him what he thinks President Obama ought to be doing.
Well, I would advise him to move on four tracks simultaneously. One is that he has to look at options such as intelligence, perhaps drone strikes, to prevent the fall of Baghdad and strengthen the residual Iraqi forces that stay there, that are still there. So that's one. Two is he has to work to get Prime Minister Maliki and use the leverage of security assistance to do a true unity government and power sharing. Because what's the root cause of this crisis is the Sunni-Shia divide right across the region, but particularly in Iraq. And Prime Minister Maliki has had a hard time working with moderate Sunni leaders. And that has to be repaired, for without it, this problem will be with us on and off. And the third track is obviously providing humanitarian assistance to lots of people that have been affected or in the Kurdistan region of Iraq. They need to be helped. And fourth is to really focus in a much more significant way to deal with the Syrian crisis, because that too is really one of the major sources of why what's happening in Iraq is happening.
And you mentioned Prime Minister Maliki there. How practically, then, can the U.S. ensure that that sectarian divide's bridged? Because it doesn't seem to have worked so far.
Well, I think the current crisis should be a wake-up call to Maliki. This is not going to be helpful to him, what has happened in his effort to remain prime minister. It needs help more desperately than ever before. And that could concentrate the mind. Our diplomacy at the very highest levels in a very clever and effective manner needs to send that message loud and clear that without that, American assistance isn't going to be effective, and that why should America do something that's not effective, that's not in the interest of the United States, it's not also in the interest of Iraq.
And there were reports yesterday that Prime Minister Maliki asked the US for airstrikes, but that request was denied. What have you heard about that?
I don't know anything about the official communications. I'm not in the government anymore. But I can see that given the circumstances in which Mr. Maliki finds himself, that he's reaching out, especially to the United States, that knows the Iraqi military and has been there in a big way until 2011, that he would ask for help. But that desire or request or desperate plea for help provides the opportunity to go for a more comprehensive approach. But be prepared to help, of course, with regard to Baghdad not falling.
The former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, talking there to FSN's Lorna Shaddock. Hawkish voices here in Washington are urging President Obama to take a tougher line. Just yesterday, House Speaker John Boehner accused the president of taking a nap while events in Iraq worsened. But do the circumstances on the ground give rise to a military strategy with any chance of success? Colin Freeman, chief foreign correspondent with Britain's Daily Telegraph newspaper, told LBC Radio's Lisa Aziz he's not so sure.
Yes, certainly. Without any troops on the ground, it makes a job that was difficult enough when they were there that much more difficult. The best they can offer really is airstrikes. That is something that is not necessarily very effective anyway, because these militants blend in with the local civilian populations. Hard to hit them with airstrikes, and of course the risk of hitting civilians and making matters worse.
Meanwhile, Colin, we hear that ominous news, of course, that those militants, the ISIS, they're heading for the capital, Baghdad. I think they're also heading for Karbala, which is the holy city of the Shiite leadership. Widespread desertion by Iraqi troops. What are you hearing just now? And what are the hopes of the government there regaining control?
Well, certainly taking the north of Iraq is a slightly different prospect from taking Baghdad itself, which is, of course, the home of the government and also home to large numbers of Shia Iraqis. That we would imagine that the capital will be much more staunchly defended. What is also worrying, though, is that if the army doesn't step up to the breach, then Shia militias will. And that really could signal the start of the government losing control. The Shia militias were involved played a leading part in the civil war that took place in Iraq about 5 years ago, in which about 30,000 people were killed.
What's your assessment also of what's happening across the borders? I mean, how will Syria be viewing the situation? Also the Shia neighbour Iran, of course. I mean, do they risk the ire of those Sunni militants if they do step in?
Yes, there have been reports of Iran sending troops to assist militarily already. Were that to happen, that would really add fuel to the fire, because the Sunni militants see both Iran and the Iraqi government, both of which are Shia governments, Shia regimes, as sworn enemies. So there is the possibility of a regional conflagration.
Colin Freeman, the chief foreign correspondent with Britain's Daily Telegraph. He was talking there to Lisa Aziz on LBC Radio. This is FSN Reports. While Iraq was making the headlines here in Washington, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was in London giving a keynote speech to delegates from Africa and around the world on the final day of a four-day summit aimed at ending gender violence in war zones. The Secretary of State pledged a further $2.5 million to fund programs aimed at helping children in conflict. The week-long event has resulted in 155 countries signing up to a declaration aimed at better documenting and preventing sexual attacks. FSN's London correspondent Dan Whitehead has been at the conference all week, and here's his final report.
Joining forces with fellow diplomats, the US Secretary of State John Kerry flew in to lend his support to the End Sexual Violence in Conflict Summit here in London. At this final session of a week-long summit, the UN Special Envoy for Refugees Angelina Jolie, who has been here all week, told delegates action is urgently needed.
There are thousands of people living in the shadows of sexual violence at this very moment. There are conflicts where rape is openly incited. Young lives are being ruined by sexual violence in Syria, South Sudan, and the Central African Republic as we gather here, as we speak.
Throughout the summit, government representatives have been meeting with charity workers, doctors, and lawyers, all of whom work on the ground in conflict zones to stop sexual violence being used as a weapon. Sadia Abdi from Action Aid has been helping run a stall here and told me it's all about responsibility.
So what I want to see that the states should be accountable for their commitment to bring justice to the perpetrators, to make sure that women are the bad ambassador of their programs.
An international protocol was launched earlier this week by the British Foreign Secretary William Hague. It's a comprehensive checklist which essentially outlines just what governments have to do to eradicate the problem. Zambia, Uganda, Nigeria, Chad and the DRC are among the countries which have signed up. US Secretary of State John Kerry closed this session, saying we can and will end impunity.
Recently, a friend of mine asked me, he said, why now? Why this conference now? After all, this person, this friend, had been a student of warfare, had fought in a war, and he reminded me that sexual violence against women is a conflict that is as old as conflict itself. Well, there's a reason why marauding armies, he said, thousands of years ago coined the phrase rape, pillage, and plunder. The norm of battle, the trilogy of terror that reflected the rights of conquerors. So why now? Because thousands of years after rape was written into the lexicon of warfare, we know that it is time to write it out and to banish sexual violence to the dark ages and the history books where it belongs.
Hollywood celebrities and political heavyweights, including John Kerry, have backed this cause. All have taken to this stage to tell governments represented here that what's been said this week must now be converted into real action. Dan Whitehead, London.
Now to the World Cup in Brazil, and while the Brazilian team gave its fans plenty to celebrate with a win over Croatia in the month-long tournament's opening game, the tournament itself has proved controversial with some Brazilians who say it isn't bringing tangible benefits to the country's poorest citizens. Protests took place in a handful of cities worldwide yesterday, and we caught up with this Brazilian on the streets of London.
When the population doesn't do anything, the corruption just grows up and grows up. That's why we are here, because the World Cup is starting today, and 600,000 families losing their house in Brazil. And this World Cup is been spending more money than the last three World Cups together.
The run-up to the World Cup has been overshadowed by allegations of corruption within soccer's governing body, FIFA, specifically over the award of the 2022 World Cup to Qatar. Jason Cowley is the editor of the left-leaning British news magazine The New Statesman. And in its cover story this week, he writes an article entitled The Last World Cup, After Brazil 2014, Is the Tournament Finished? He's been speaking in London to New Statesman correspondent Ian Steadman.
I was having a little bit of fun by saying it's the last World Cup, but what I meant is it the last authentic World Cup? You can see why Brazil would want to host a World Cup. Football, in many ways, is a supreme instrument of soft power in the world. It's the global game. It's the global language in many ways. And Brazil's a great football country. I mean, it's won the World Cup five times. And it's right that the tournament is there. But at the same time, there's huge problems inside the country, massive unrest. You've had protests, strikes, marches against the World Cup, but also against government incompetence, corruption and indifference. At the same time, this particular tournament is shadowed once again by FIFA corruption. Some excellent allegations in the Sunday Times about how the decision to host, the decision to give the World Cup to Qatar in particular in 2022 looks as if it was bought. And indeed, the decision also to give it to Putin's Russia in 2018 looks deeply murky as well. So this is the backdrop to this tournament. FIFA, at best, is opaque. At worst, is corrupt. Every World Cup becomes that much more expensive. I mean, the Brazilians have spent in excess of $10 billion. Still, the stadiums aren't ready. Massive infrastructure projects haven't been completed in time. And this is a country, what, nearly 200 million people, 50 million of whom live in abject poverty.
The viral image of this World Cup so far is a piece of graffiti where the artist has drawn a crying, starving child sitting at a table with a football on his plate. And that's become the image that sums up all the protests and the riots and the fury about it. And it feels like there is kind of this head of steam building towards maybe Blatter resigning.
Sepp Blatter, president of FIFA, and indeed president's a good word for him because FIFA operates almost like a kind of country or state, has that kind of power. And the World Cup for FIFA is this huge engine of, well-oiled engine of cash generation. And you can see why some of the members or many of the members of FIFA, most of which are from the developing world, would want Blatter to remain in power. I mean, that's his power base. It's not the big European countries. And he's generating, or his tournament is generating, huge revenues. Where I think, for me, this is why I'm calling it the last World Cup, because FIFA at present is deeply odious, and why should we participate? But where reform could come, and you hinted at it, is the power of the clubs, particularly the big European clubs. And Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, the chairman of Bayern Munich in particular, has spoken out already against FIFA and Blatter. And if reform is to come, it could be forced by the clubs, by Bayern, Juventus, Milan, Barca, Real Madrid, Manchester United, plus the corporate sponsors. Five of the six major sponsors of this tournament, led by Sony, have spoken out about the corruption allegations, and they're very concerned. So if there's change, I don't think it will come from inside FIFA, but it might come from external pressure.
That's Jason Cowley, the editor of The New Statesman, and you can read his article about the 2014 World Cup online at newstatesman.com. Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, and a discussion about the role of the state. At a time when politicians often debate the role and size of government in the lives of people, a new book asserts that, in fact, Western countries have proved remarkably adept at advancing societies through a constant reimagination of the state. The Fourth Revolution, The Global Race to Reinvent the State, is written by John Micklethwaite, the editor of The Economist, and Adrian Wooldridge, a columnist with the newspaper. They spoke to The Economist's literary editor, Fia Mataroko, and John Micklethwaite kicks things off.
I think what inspired this was the idea that politics seemed to be broken, that everybody seems to be in a big fuss, a big mess about politics. But when you look around the world, people don't quite see that there is this kind of global contest evolving, this global contest to reinvent the state. And if you just sit in America, you don't see what's happening in China. You sit in Britain, you don't see what's happening in Sweden. And that is really a very big thing. And people at the moment have this amazing idea that they're fed up with government, and yet at the same time, they think nothing will change. You look at history, and in fact, you should expect exactly the opposite.
You've called it the Fourth Revolution. Adrian, what radical changes have we seen with the state in history?
Well, the first revolution is a public order revolution. It's a revolution in the 16th and 17th centuries, which is particularly associated with Thomas Hobbes. And that's the idea that the first job of the state is to provide public order. The second revolution is a revolution that really begins in the 18th century and reaches fruition in the mid-19th century. And that's a sort of liberal revolution, which is the idea that the state has to be constrained. You have to have certain rights that are guaranteed for the individual and has to be held accountable for its actions. In the 18th century, you've got this rather parasitical state, and it's pulled back in the 19th century. In the 20th century, you have this idea that the function of the state is to provide a minimum degree of welfare for everybody. So public order, liberty, welfare.
John, one of the central ideas that I found most interesting reading the book was the notion that the secret to making the economy work was making government work better. But Western politicians have become accustomed to giving people more and more, more healthcare, more security, more entitlements. That's what they need to do to get re-elected. In order to work better, government needs to be reformed. But how can you reform the state in a democracy?
It's very difficult. There's the famous quote of the European politician saying, we know all the answers, but we just don't know how to get elected once we've tried those answers. And the same is true everywhere. You've got people very, very angry with their governments. You look at the numbers for approval ratings for Congress, down to about 10%, membership of political parties. That is a real difficulty in terms of what sits there. Against that, the alternative is what else? You have to act on the fact that the state is running out of money. It's not just because of the crunch and the debts built up then. It's because of demographic factors. It's because the number of, in the West particularly, the number of us who are going to end up old and relying on the state has to get better. It has, for both right and left, to be able to find a way to make better use of the resources it has.
Asian governments, on the whole, haven't been deliverers of very, very big spending for their populations. They are clearly thinking about this problem a lot, but they're not looking to the West for inspiration. Why is that?
That's the really interesting thing. The book begins at a China Executive Leadership Academy. It's essentially in Shanghai, and it's a place where they send all their leaders to go and get trained. Those people go and scour the world looking for ideas, and they go to Silicon Valley, they go to Wall Street, they do not go to Washington, they do not go to Westminster. They do go to Scandinavia, as Adrian said, they go to Singapore. The reason why it matters so much to China is because China used to be the best at government. China used to be the model. Go up to the 16th century, China had the best government. The West beat China by having better government, and that is something which they are incredibly conscious of. Our three revolutions, three and a half if you count Thatcher and Reagan, these were all ways in which the West got ahead of Asia. This time, Asia is determined to battle back. So for the first time for 500-600 years, the West suddenly faces an alternative, and much more so, the West is in a competition and it doesn't know it. The Chinese do.
Is the prospect of Asian countries looking for an alternative narrative for the state a real challenge for the West?
I think it is, yes. It's a challenge largely because the West haven't yet got hold of it. Because you look around the emerging world and people are trying to make choices. You have a choice between following the Beijing consensus of relatively authoritarian government and state capitalism and things like that, or you have the West. And you look at Washington, and do you necessarily want to have a political system like that? All those things are happening at the moment. For 10, 15 years ago, it was assumed the Washington consensus was completely ruling the roost. Now it's got a rival. And that, I think, does make a difference.
So there's a battle here about economic or geopolitical preeminence, which we've had for many reasons. But one of the basic reasons we've had it is that we've had efficient, successful, dynamic state systems. But there's also a battle for preeminence in terms of ideas. What we've had is liberalism, democracy, an emphasis on liberty, and we're seeing a coherent challenge to those values, which say we can be efficient, we can be modern, but we don't need to put liberty and democracy at the heart of that. So I think the stakes are very, very high here.
John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wooldridge of The Economist. Their book, The Fourth Revolution, The Global Race to Reinvent the State, is out now, and it is published by Penguin. And that brings us to an end of this Friday edition of FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks in Washington for everyone with FSN everywhere. Have a terrific weekend. We'll see you on Monday. Goodbye.